FTBL podcast. With the Women's World Cup draw taking place this weekend, we've got Emma Highwood, Head of Women's Sport, Youth Development and Community at the FFA, in to talk about the Matildas, W League, governance issues, regio fees, all the big issues. Don't miss it.
Whoa! That's one of the strikes of the season! Whoa!
Welcome to the FTBL podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Busy time for you.
Yeah, there's a bit happening in the game. lots of good stuff at the moment. But yeah, we'll be working right up to Christmas and pre-Christmas with the leagues continuing. And then we've got a few big tournaments next year.
A few big changes just come through.
That's right, yeah.
Has there been much... Has the dust settled yet on that?
I think it's still settling. I think that one of the big changes from my perspective, which I'm really looking forward to, is the establishment of the Women's Council. So having a kind of constituted group now that can help us focus on the women's game from elite down to the grassroots is good, and having, you know, the ability for women across the game to come in and feed into the future strategy is pretty exciting. So in particular, I'm looking forward to working with Roz and the rest of the Women's Council as well.
There was a women's group within the FFA before, was it not? It just wasn't part of Congress.
Yeah, so there was a board subcommittee, and actually Chris Nicu was the chair, and prior to that Moya Dodd was the chair, and Heather Reid was actually on that committee. So
it's probably good having a female as the chair.
Yeah.
Slightly better optic.
Yeah, absolutely. However, Chris, you know, did a really good job, and I think that's really good from my perspective, because he's got a really good understanding of both the kind of successes and also the challenges ahead in the women's game. So, and having Heather, who was on that committee, now on the board, is, you know, fantastic. And I also would like to acknowledge what a, you know, great opportunity for the game to now have a female in the deputy chair role. And I think she'll bring a lot of expertise on gender equality, but also across the whole grassroots game as well.
And hopefully an extra couple of females from the appointed directors too.
Yeah, so I mean, that was one of the exciting things about the Congress Working Group, was this commitment towards a 40-40-20 rule. And obviously that will come to life in the board, but the plan is that filters down to the whole game as well. So all of our federations moving to that kind of position. I mean, ideally it's 50-50, but 40-40-20 is a good step forward. But yeah, that'll be a strategic opportunity for us going forward as well.
Just, I probably should have said this right at the beginning, you are head of youth development, women's football, and there's one other as well?
Yeah, so my official title is head of community, which is the grassroots area of the game, football development, which is working with the TD around the pathway, coaching development in particular, and pathway area, and then the other area is women's football. And my role in women's football is less operational and more strategic, so I drive the strategy of women's football across FFA, and then also working with stakeholders as well in that space.
That's quite a few hats to be wearing.
It is quite a few hats, and I find that I kind of have to change gears a fair bit throughout the day, whether I'm talking, you know, women's football or going into the more technical space. And we don't have a lot of resources in comparison to perhaps our other competitors. So, yeah, it's certainly challenging at times, but I do it because I'm a football person and I'm passionate about football. I'm from England originally. So, yeah, always played the game, always worked in football in the UK and here. So I think to some degree you've got to have really good, you know, passion and drive to work in this game, because it is tough at times. And as I said, you've got to be committed to kind of the longer term opportunities ahead, because we don't have a lot of resources right now. So we've got to work smart, we've got to work with stakeholders really closely, and you know, drive that strategy.
I've heard you described as pretty much David Gallup's number two in this setup. Is that fair?
Look, I think he's got a few offsiders that he works with. I just kind of get my head down and try and do the best that I can in my area. And you know, I think we've had, you know, I am a person that reflects on the last few years and we'll say we've got some stuff right and we've got some stuff wrong. And I think that on the women's side, there's a lot of positives. And on the pathway, there's been a lot of good work that's taken place over the last 10 to 12 years since the creation of FFA, but there is still some major challenges for our game in that space. And and the community, again, is, you know, a good area where you look at it and you say there's been overall growth, which is fantastic, but our ability to service the grassroots, it has been a challenge, whether that's from FFA through to federations. So yeah, it's still much, a lot more to do. I mean, I'm the type of person that thinks that football can be the number one sport in this country. It's just a matter of when and how. So if you kind of, you know, believe in the game in that way, then you just got to keep roll your sleeves up and keep moving forward as much as you can.
With just going back again back to the changes that have come through, David Gallup was on the radio on Monday just talking about how it's caused a bit of stagnation over the last couple of years. How has that affected you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been challenging when the stakeholders as a group have been focused on the Congress issue, which has been difficult to get their kind of headspace into other issues across the game. So, and there's no one that's felt that more than me working with the federations, where, you know, there's no doubt that if we're going to move forward, particularly in areas like the pathway, we need to have a whole of game approach, and that requires buy-in from the top of the game, from the FFA board through to the owners, through to the presidents. And when all of those individuals are focused on you know, trying to resolve the Congress issue, and a lot of time and effort went into that through a lot of volunteers in those spaces, it's very difficult to then tackle some of the other big strategic issues across the game. So there was no one more excited than me when the Congress issue, you know, was resolved, and then in turn the board is now set, because I think that it gives us the opportunity to really get the headspace of our key stakeholders in the area of, you know, working together and tackling some of those big issues that we need to kind of hit head on together. And one of them in particular is cost of football. You know, that's a particular issue where as a whole game we need to figure out how we're going to deal with that. It's not something that can be FFA led without working with clubs and stakeholders across the game.
Were you caught in the crossfire between the two sides? Were you getting pressure exerted from one to say, get them to do this, or get federations on side with us again?
No, I have to say my area is development, and I just focused on doing my job and focused on, you know, developing the game, and worked with my colleagues, the CEOs and member federations. And, you know, obviously there wasn't probably much talked about other than Congress for the last few years, but there still has been a lot of progress that's happened across the game. We just haven't really been able to get that message out. I was, you know, wasn't caught up, I have to say, and, you know, it wasn't kind of in my area. I just wanted to focus on continuing to develop the game while other people at the top of the game are kind of focused on, I suppose, that governance future.
There did seem to, I think it was quite an eye-opener for a lot of football fans, and probably for the media as well, just the politics, the suits, the work that went on behind the scenes, and the affiliations, alliances, and it must be almost impossible not to get caught up in that.
For me, I didn't end up getting caught up in that. It was something that people just knew not to engage me on those kind of issues. The only thing that it did for a period of time, as I said, it was just difficult to get people's headspace on issues relating to day-to-day kind of management of the game, rather than focusing on who's going to be on the board or, you know, what the Congress model should be. So I agree that as a game, we're only going to be successful if we collaborate. People need to understand intimately the issues that the game is facing at an FFA perspective in terms of financial, because some of those issues are going to be difficult to tackle, and it's not just going to be about FFA, it has to be a whole of game approach to that. So I think that that's been the major challenge from my perspective, is getting people to think of those more longer term kind of challenging issues that we need to focus on, require a lot of attention and understanding. It's just for a 2-year period it became almost impossible to do that. So despite that, I mean, I think that when I work with my fellow colleagues in the member fed CEOs, we've got a really good group of individuals in that space, and everyone there is committed to growing the game. So I kind of come out of the process you know, feeling quite positive about the future and what we can achieve. And, you know, I also look at this and I look at the pathway space in particular and think that, you know, people want to grow the game. They're ambitious and they're passionate, and we just need to give people the vehicle to actually be part of that. I think that's probably the biggest learning to take out of the Congress and where we are now, is that, you know, there's a lot of passionate people that want to be part of growing the game here, and we need to provide those vehicles and be more open and collaborative around some of that stuff.
Since the boardroom coup, as it were, has there actually come down any messages from the mountain on changes of direction? Is anything going to be seen to be different? Obviously, it's freeing you up to carry on the work that you're doing better.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a really important point because we're about to go for a refresh of the FFA strategy. So I think that will give the new board the opportunity to actually work with management on, you know, what the priorities should be going forward. The FFA board hasn't met yet, so we haven't had much coming down from that perspective. But I think that, you've got a different board. You've got people that have very deep connections to different areas of the game, and I think that will be a good thing. And, I think it's a well-balanced board as well. So, yeah, I'm excited to work with the new board, and I think that, I think Chris will be a great chair, and I think Heather brings a lot of experience from her time in Capital Football. She's obviously someone that understands women's football intimately, and I think that combination is a really good one and something that I'm looking forward to working closely with them on.
I think from a fan's perspective as well, there possibly is still a bit of disappointment that there's not more people involved at a high professional level on the board. Obviously there's former players, but not the Craig Fosters, the Katie Gills, or people like that that have actually played the game at that level.
Yeah, and I think that we should, in the future, it would be good, to have. My personal view is I think that we should have players on the board. I don't think there should be any area of the game which can't be represented. But certainly that's something that I think is, an important thing for the game, because those individuals have, like you say, played to the highest level. And if you look across member association boards internationally, it's not unusual to have players involved in the game. And I think where we need to head as a game generally is respecting everyone's role and the role that everyone plays, and you've got to have balance. You can't have you do have to have people with business acumen, you need to have people with football acumen, and you need to have people that have got a degree of independence. And I think that all of those things are important, and having that balance is important for the future of the game.
Just going back to what you said a few minutes ago, the refresh of the FFA strategy, what does that actually involve?
So we're in the last 6 months of our current strategy, so we'll be working through a process, and this will be led with the new board around how we're going to evolve the strategy that we currently have in place. So and I think that'll be thinking about how we consult with the community, how we make those choices around the key priorities, and obviously with this board, I think that they'll have some key priorities that they would like us to focus on, and the strategy will be a good opportunity to kind of hone that down. So
following on from that then, so the W League has obviously come on a long way in 10 years. I was at the Big Blue and at the weekend.
Yeah.
And the difference between those first games and the first season and where we're at now is just huge. But we still got limited number of sides, limited season. And how do you see the league developing from here? Where do we go?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think that we, as you said, we've come a long way from year one, and I remember watching the Double League in year one to where it is now. It started as a development league. It's emerging now, and I was at the Big Blue over the weekend as well. You know, we had around 5,000 people to that game for the Double League, and you had a double, as I like to call it, which is brilliant. In terms of the journey, has been a pretty good one, and we've got a sustainable league now, which is really important. I think there's both opportunities and challenges in the W League, which are both domestic and international. So domestically, we're competing now with other sports, AFL. If you speak to, or if you hear the PR from AFL, you'd assume that AFL invented women's sport, but obviously we've been here for a very long time, and We've got Matildas that have played the game over generations, Judy Dolan being one of them. So we've got a strong history in women's sport. Before it was sexy, and it was before it was the thing that everyone wanted to do. So
we hit peak sexy about 2000.
Yeah.
Did you count and
realize? Yeah,
too,
maybe that's
too sexy,
not.
Too sexy.
Yeah, maybe let's not talk about that one. But I think that something that I actually would like us to do more, and I think Heather's pretty passionate about this too, is actually talking about the history of the women's game, because there is a strong history here in Australia of generations of national teams, and it's something that we should definitely be celebrating, and I think you'll see more of that happening in the future as well. But in terms of the domestic space, yeah, we've got more competition than ever before. We're also competing with sports that their main focus in women's sport is their league, and for us, obviously, our strategy is broader. We've got a focus on getting more girls at the grassroots. We've got a focus on the W League and the Matildas as well. We've competed with sports in that regard. We've got sports that have their leagues on free to air, and that just gives you the broader reach that we would struggle to compete with. And then on the international front, you've got more and more countries now investing in women's football, investing in professional leagues. Our top Matildas are going to be lured more and more to play probably in parts of Europe for some of the big, European clubs. And we know that that's starting to kind of happen. And the season's growing overseas as well. So I only saw this morning in the US League, because of the break with the Women's World Cup, they'll be playing right into October. So for us, this current strategy which we're in would say we have a shorter season, and we enable our best players to play overseas and play here in Australia for the W League. That's going to be difficult going forward. So we've got some choices to make around, whether we want to be seen as a world-class league, and if we want to be seen as a world-class league, then we need to think of the length of the season. We need to kind of back ourselves to keep the best Matildas and attract world-class players, and not be so concerned about other leagues. Or you make the decision that, having a, as I call, bit of the meat in the sandwich, which is perhaps what the W League is at the moment, is kept to a short period so that players can continue to explore overseas opportunities. So there is some kind of strategic decisions we have to make. Other sports we compete with perhaps don't have those pressures that we do in terms of the international space. They can just focus on developing what I'd call commercial leagues. So you look at what AFL have done, and for them the important thing was just establishing something and giving as many clubs the opportunity to be part of that as possible. I think that they have struggled because there's the motivation of what the national body wants versus how the players feel and want to be respected. And certainly something that I'm pretty passionate about is that women play the same game as men and don't start changing size of the pitch and the length of the, all of that. What you should do is invest in, give women the same opportunities that men have, give them the right training environment, pay them so that they can focus full time on football, and give them time. I think that's what has been proven with the W League, and you've seen the conditioning, the quality of football increase year on year. They still played the same game though over 10 years ago. I think that we have to kind of think about how we compete domestically, and then also how can we ensure the W League is a proper football league for us that achieves football objectives, as well as staying on par with what's happening internationally. And all those things will be important. I think that there'll be a consideration around A-League separation, and W League will be considered as part of that as well. So certainly there's an opportunity to think about that as part of that process. But I think there's a lot of upside in the W League, and maybe I'm biased, but I think it's the best women's product out there from a league perspective.
I was actually going to ask you this, because this was a question I asked a TWG team, because they obviously know much more than I do, about where they thought the W League ranked globally in relation to the other women's leagues around the world. Where would you put us?
So in a domestic sense, I'd say that our women's product is the best in, probably I'd say netball, and then I reckon we're on par with netball in terms of having best women's product. So if I look at cricket, no disrespect to cricket or AFL, but I just think the quality of football, and I speak to football fans, right, who now go, it's not just about W League. I go to the game because it's really good football.
Yes.
It's not about gender anymore. It's just like, I want to watch Alana Kennedy, you know, slot a free kick.
Absolutely.
And in fact, I was at the game and I said to my colleague, Tracy Scott, who runs the W League, we're at the game, and I said, watch this. I said, I bet she puts this in, because there was a, you know, very, very good positioning for Alana. But so I think there's certainly, that element. But internationally, I think we're in the top five. But I think that we have to invest or we're going to be left behind. And again, that will become a strategic choice for the game to say that we need to make an investment here over the long term in the W League, because I think that an incremental kind of investment is probably not going to get us, it's not going to keep us on par with what's happening internationally. So and that, you know, may be investment from other areas of the game coming into the W League for a period of time, or we build as we grow in terms of the commercial revenue that we can also bring in. But certainly when you look at what's happening, it's because it's not just the leagues now, it's individual clubs. So you've got like a Barcelona, finally Manchester United have a team. I mean I come from the UK, I come from London, but my mum is from Manchester, and I was quite disappointed for years why Man United never had a women's team, but Man City kind of has shown them up completely. But you've got those kind of clubs investing now, so it's going to become more attractive, and our Matildas are going to be targeted, no doubt, to play.
I've never actually seen the UK women play at club level. Is it a quality on a par with, in relative terms, to the men and globally, or...?
You mean the Women's League in the
England.
UK? Yeah, I mean, they've put a lot of money into the Women's League in the UK. I think our product is better. We actually get more people to games, believe it or not.
That doesn't surprise me.
They've got a real challenge over there. I mean, I worked over there. Men's football is just so dominant and ingrained. It's very difficult to get any kind of coverage. There's a real stigma still around women playing football. Whereas here, because in parts of the country football is still seen as a growing sport, there's been this opportunity to kind of build the A-League and the W-League together. And I'm a big fan, and I don't just say this because I'm passionate about the women's game, but I think the women's game can help football. This is not just about saying let's grow women's football, it's also about saying if we want to reach our potential here, we want more participants, more fans, more revenue coming into the game, we've got to unlock 50% of the population. Lots of research highlights that females are, you know, make decisions around purchasing power, around what their kids play, and also whether their kids go to certain sporting events, etc. So that's the opportunity that football has here, and we don't necessarily have the same stigma that I think which I experienced in England. I'm not saying there aren't issues in terms of, you know, discrimination or disrespect that happens, but the stigma there is so ingrained that that's what I think they're up against, because I think the clubs are investing a lot more. The environments are becoming really professional. They've definitely got the high performance kind of environment really moving in the right direction, leveraging what's there in the men's side.
Yeah.
And that's what we would find difficult to compete with when a Chelsea or a Man City starts to kind of, you know, leverage the men's...
Start doing what Melbourne City have been doing.
Exactly what Melbourne City are doing, then obviously that's difficult for us to compete with, because those clubs have got, you know, generations of ingrained kind of history. But I think that from a commercial perspective here and from a fan's perspective, women's football linked to the Matildas has a special place in Australian society right now, and that's the opportunity that I think we have here, and they don't have that in England. It's not the same.
The TWG team did come back to me and say that basically the biggest shortcoming is this length of the season.
Yeah.
Is the expansion of the A-League, how much of a criteria is the W-League element of that related?
Yeah, so we've done a bit of work, which I'm pretty proud of, with the PFA and the players generally. So when we established the pay and conditions last year, which meant that every player that is in the league gets paid, which was a step forward for our sport. As part of that, we were also talking about how do we work together around the strategy of the W League, so it wasn't just a kind of simple negotiation. And we've set up a women's professional working group, which has FFA and the PFA and A-League W League clubs represented. And so we talked about key priorities in terms of the W League. The first one was obviously paying conditions. It's almost like a foundational thing that we had to just get right. Then last year we talked about the second priority being ensuring that every game was streamed or broadcast as a minimum. So that was what we've moved forward with this year. And then we did some work around kind of as a group agreeing what the next order of priorities. And for us, full home and away is really the next step, and then the fourth kind of step would be expansion. You know, I think that Heather Reid is very passionate about this too. It's important for the league that we get to full home and away. It's something that we need to do, and that's going to cost money, and as a priority that would be where we would go first, and then obviously expansion. And when we look at expansion, it's not just always about tagging on to what's happening with the A-League. So, for example, if you expanded at the same rate with the W-League, what we just talked about in terms of our product would be impacted, because there's just a basic numbers difference with the number of women that play our game here. So you've got to take that in consideration, have that lens on expansion. So with that view, it's not necessarily, you know, every A-League club straight away gets a team. It's actually thinking about, okay, what is the next team of the A-League clubs that perhaps have those, you know, teams in place. And without knowing where we're going to land with the A-League, it's difficult. But certainly, you know, if we could go every game streamed, full home and away, and expansion, we would explore all of that. But if we had to prioritise, that was kind of the order that we landed in. But I think that also the next expansion team for W League, we should be asking the same question that we asked for A League. What is this team going to do for the W League?
What's going to bring?
Yeah, and I think that I would say what Melbourne City brought was they took the bar to another level. So you look at that expansion decision, you say that was a great one for the league. That's what we need next. It needs to be a team that's going to come in and help raise the bar, or help reach a different audience, or fill a gap in the pathway. It's got to help solve one of those problems.
None of which are really arguments in favour of Central Coast Mariners.
Well, I mean, that's the consideration that we have to make, is around that. So, you know, I'm not saying that Central Coast Mariners wouldn't do a good job, but it's about saying, you know, what are the key objectives that we need an expansion team to solve, and then looking at what opportunities there are out there, and something that, you know, sometimes I think in women's football you're stuck frying the steak knives kind of thing, and with the opportunity we have with the W League, we've got to take the same care and consideration that we've taken around expansion of A League to W League. So, and I, you know, there's been a lot of chat around A League expansion and not very much around W League. So
been overlooked.
It's been overlooked completely. So as a game, I'd say that's where we're at right now.
I think probably the reason it has been overlooked is because you've got Mariners there wanting now to
perhaps
get a team back in getting blocked all the time. So expansion is clearly not necessarily a top priority, it would appear from the outside.
Yeah, and look, and when we brought in Melbourne City, we had to consider the impact that had on the pool of players. We've obviously got a lot of young players already in the W League. You know, there's different views on that, but perhaps it's not a good thing that our average age is so young. Some people think it's great that we're giving young players the opportunity. So there's all these kind of areas that we need to balance up around the football objective, the broader growth of the W League objective, you know, and then kind of where it sits in terms of women's football more broadly as well.
For that full home and away season, do you have any kind of timeline that ideally you'd like to see that coming in?
Well, I mean, we'll be exploring it for next season, and I think the key thing that we'll need to look at, there's a financial element to that, so we have to kind of, that will have to go into the mix with other things, other choices that we'll have to make. But the other logistical element is working with Fox around the window we have with Fox, and also if the players are playing overseas, when those other leagues, or particularly the US, is starting and finishing. So that's always a challenge, and we've got FIFA windows now that we've respected as part of the strategy this year. So we had the Matildas games against Chile, and we broke for those games. That's the first time that we've done that. So it is logistically complex. And that's, we've got to work through all those different variables. I mean, the other consideration is, do you play more midweek games, which on the men's game you can do quite easily. On the women's, these players have other jobs. There's only maybe 15 to 20 that might be full-time on football, so therefore you've got to respect that. And so there's other considerations that can kind of complex this. And this is why it shouldn't just be something that we work on. FFA needs to work with the PFA closely. We need to work with the clubs closely on all of that to make sure we land in a space that, you know, is a positive thing for the game.
Talking off the finances, Westfield as a sponsor, no Lowy involvement. Westfield and Lowy's have gone the separate ways pretty much anyway. How is that going to affect you guys?
Well, we're out for tender at the moment on our women's commercial products. So, look, we're already talking to, you know, different partners, as you should do across the game. So I don't see that it would probably have an impact at this stage, and I certainly haven't heard that they're going to withdraw their support just because the Lowys aren't in the game at the moment. But, yeah, we'll have to wait and see how that pans out. But I think that what I would say is, outside of the Lowy involvement, you know, Westfield have actually leveraged a fair bit out of being connected to football, and it's been a really good fit product for them. And, you know, I think that with the explosion of women's sport, you know, they were to make a decision which is about, you know, seeing women's football still as a is an important part of helping with their kind of broader brand strategy, then, you know, then I think it still ticks all of those boxes for them. But look, from our perspective, we also want to make sure that we have really good partners in women's football, that it's not just about the cash, it's also about how we activate together and grow the game. And, you know, we've had not just Westfield supporting women's football. You've also got, you know, the likes of Caltex, which have been a supporting partner, Nike, NAB, Rebel. Yeah, and all of those things are not just about the cash that they provide, which helps us to do more, obviously. It's also about, well, how can they help promote the game? And I think Rebel's a really, really great example. NAB have done some really great stuff with the Matildas in terms of activations. Hyundai have as well. so, yeah, I think that I think people probably have assumed that our women's football commercial offering has just always been about Westfield, and it was probably 2 or 3 years ago, but it's evolved now to much broader partnerships across the game as well. Yeah, it's. I think that we'll be making choices which are, A, about bringing revenue to support the ongoing strategy of women's football, and make sure we make choices around, you know, the best fit partners as well.
Excellent. Again, on finances, the big constant talking point, and has been for years, registration fees.
Yeah.
What can you do about them? I think the message finally starts to get out this year that the FFA's share of a registration fee is actually pretty small.
Small, yeah.
But the Federation's obviously charging a lot. Coaches get charged a lot for their licences and the training fees for that. And I think the issue with the other sports is that they're feeding down. They're subsidising registration fees rather than taking any kind of registration fee. Well, obviously, it's a question of finances, but what can be done about it?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably two elements to this. There's the national registration fee, which is the NRF, which has been in place now for a number of years, and it is a small portion of what a player pays. And, you know, we reinvest that back to federations in particular in terms of funding for programs and development officers, and that's something that we've had in place for a while now. And then there's the broader cost of football. But you highlight some really good points, because the whole game right now, there isn't money flowing down to federations, to grassroots clubs. So each area, each level of the game takes a fee, and that's what kind of builds up the registration fee, including clubs as well. And I have to say that the majority of the fee is actually in the club space. There's nothing wrong with that, because they're actually paying for the facilities. They've got to hire the coaches. And I spoke about this not so long ago in regards to cost of football, but in the same way we talk about, you know, pressure on families around things like rates and bills, well, that's the same if you're running a club. because you're going to have to continue to, you've got rising costs in that space and probably limited revenue opportunities, so you've got to figure out a fee that's going to help cover all of those costs. So I think for our sport it is complex, and I particularly around cost of football, we certainly see pretty high costs in the NPL environment in particular, in the elite side, and that's something that we have to work together to unlock. But a couple of years ago, as part of the last broadcast deal, we did set up what we call a community services fund, and we then distribute funds back to member federations to start doing more in that servicing space. And particularly Football New South Wales and Northern have started to do more work around investing in facilities, and you're starting to see some kind of benefits going back to the community. That's the kind of stuff that we need to be doing more of. And I think lots of sports take a fee, so there's this concept that football's the only one that has a membership fee. It's a fallacy, but there's probably more coming down.
Yeah.
And I think that, so I'm not going to sit here and say that's right or wrong, but I think that what we need to do is, as a game, work together to better service the grassroots, FFA and member federations working on that. But at the moment, resourcing in terms of the across football is pretty tight. You know, we talk about underinvestment in junior national teams. We know that the A-League, some A-League clubs are struggling. We know that we're not doing enough in the grassroots space. Perhaps futsal is an area that we should be focused on more. So there's lots of things that we look at and we go, okay, we need to be investing in those things, but there's choices that are made. So one of the things that we've started to try and do is develop more partnerships with government. To try and unlock funding around multicultural. We're also looking at doing more in the walk-in football space because governments see football as a good opportunity around reducing kind of health outcomes for older Australians. So we see that as a good opportunity for us to start to unlock more funds and work to distribute more down over time.
Because historically, football does get a very, very low percentage of government funding compared to other sports, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Why is that situation happened, do you think?
Well, historically, our government relations was Frank Lowy in the early days, and the chairman had very good connections at the top end of the game, and we did leverage money for various projects. Most other sports have government relations departments, so in this current strategy, about 2 or 3 years ago, we set up a government relations department here, and that was led by Mike Falvo, and also Rick came on board to drive that from Football New South Wales. So we're actually now seeing that we've got better relationships with government. They understand what we can offer more. So we're actually starting to get more traction with government. And the other key thing in that space is it can't just be each part of the game going to government asking for money. They like AFL, they like cricket, they like netball because they go as a whole of a game.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't just go individually. So that's something that we need to be aligned on and actually make sure that when we go to government and speak to government, we're speaking as one game and we're selling our game because not everybody understands the size of the game at the grassroots. Or, they're starting to understand a bit more now, but also about the women's side, the multicultural side, how we can help government achieve their objectives around physical activity, social inclusion. And when we talk about, some of the perceived challenges in Melbourne around, the Sudanese community, well, I come from England, and in England, football was the first sport that you went to help kind of tackle some of these
yep.
issues, to make people feel like they're part of the community, to assimilate. So I think football is really well placed around helping government meet those objectives, but and we're now starting to do that more. I think we're in a position now where we can actually start to do that.
Is that something that's getting enough visibility, do you think?
No, I mean, that's something that's been happening probably during the whole Congress issue that people probably aren't really aware of. Certainly, we've spent a lot of time building relationships. At the moment, we've got a partnership in place with FFE. We put a joint proposal to the government in Victoria around football, starting to leverage not just the grassroots area there, but how we can connect Matildas and Socceroos packaging to help grow the whole game within one state. So that's a first for us, that we've kind of put a joint package that leverages both national and local opportunities, and it's been really well received by the Victorian government, and that's something that we'd like to replicate as part of the Women's World Cup bid. We're working side by side with the member federations as well to make sure that when we go into government, we're going in together. With that, we're not just trying to sell the bid, we're actually trying to get them to sign up to help us to grow the women's game, to sign up to gender equality, we're getting some good traction there as well. So there's been a bit happening around that behind the scenes, but until we're at a point where we can start to announce things, then obviously that's often goes unnoticed
under the radar.
Yeah, but I think just going back to your original point around the, you know, the flow of funds, it's a basic reality right now that if you just look at the total revenues of the games that we're competing with, AFL cricket, their broadcast revenue supports the whole game. So the broadcast revenue from the league helps support the whole game. And if you look at our game, we have a lot more to happening and a lot more to focus on than they do. So we've got 10 national teams. We've got A-League, W-League, FFA Cup. We're working with federations on NPL. We've got this massive grassroots, the biggest grassroots club structure in Australia of any sport to service. So when you look at that, you know, and you look at the resourcing that we have, that's the challenge that the game's got. And that's why a new board coming in has to work with management on how we can bring more revenue in, whether that's through government funding, commercial sponsorship, or even, you know, setting up a foundation where we can actually start to leverage, you know, more money to reinvest back into community programs. That should be our focus going forward, because otherwise you're just moving deck chairs around.
On the pathway thing, one of the things that the World Cup threw into sharp focus was the A-League's kind of acting as a roadblock to player development, certainly in the striker stocks, because of the marquee player deals and the importance of goals. And you can get more bang for your buck from a slightly older overseas player than you can necessarily from investing in a potential Australian star. How are we going to overcome that?
Well, I think that the key thing, and I'd say this out front, I'm not the technical director, so I think that's something that the technical director will need to
push that one to one side.
Focus on. But I think that's the challenge, right? Is in any game, you know, you've got different levers you can pull. You've got the league and how you structure a league, but there's always going to be flexibility in there for clubs to make decisions, you know, their own club culture and purchasing players and all of that. You've got the pathway, which certainly feeds into that. You've got coach education. You've got the role that grassroots clubs play. You've got this concept of second tier. So I actually think that there's lots of parts in the pathway. I feel like generally, I'm probably asking a bigger question here, but I feel like generally we've got a lot of initiatives, but we haven't necessarily built a system. And a system is something that no matter who is put in different roles, everyone is just doing the same thing, and players are just going to continue to get a consistent service, and they're going to be developed. It's not going to be dependent on a really good coach in one area, and I think that that's what we've relied on in the men's and the women's pathways for many years, to be honest. So if you want to build a system where, you know, building, we've got consistent players coming through, we've got to have a vision, we've got to have a strong leader in that space, and it's not an area where we can have misalignment. You need to have the A-League clubs knowing their role in W-League, you need to have the member federations knowing their role, grassroots has to play a role. And, you know, I see a lot of focus on individual patches across our game and not enough focus on the player. And I think that if we're really serious about developing better players at all levels on the men's and the women's pathway, we have to have a stronger focus on the player and what's in the player's needs and player development. But I would say the FFA needs to lead on that, and we need a strong leader in that space. And that's why, you know, we felt like after Russia it was time for a change with Eric and Eric Abrahams, and we have decided that, you know, we need to reset that space, and it should be continue evolving, but we should know where we're heading. And you know, some foundations have been put in place around the curriculum. There's lots of views on that. There's been some foundations around coach education. You know, we've got NPL clubs that, you know, are focused on player development. We've got Howe Academies, etc. But they're just initiatives. We've got to tie them all together. And as I said, people have to know where they fit. And then we've got challenges around cost of football. I come from England. I come from a working class family. If I was in Australia right now, I probably wouldn't reach the level that I reached in England playing the game, because my parents couldn't afford, couldn't afford it. So what does that mean? That means that, you know, and I'd say as for someone that works at FFA in the grassroots space, yes, our numbers are growing, and that's fantastic. That's a really good healthy sign of what's happening at the grassroots. Are we getting the best athletes? Oh, I'm not so sure we are, particularly on the boys' side. I think we have on the women's side, because I think at the time when this current crop of the golden is, I won't call it a golden generation, it just should be a generation, but this current crop of Matildas, when they started out, there weren't many options, you know, for them in terms of other sports. So we're quite lucky that we've actually ended up getting athletes like, I'd say, a Caitlin Ford, who could play any sport, or a Sam Kerr. You know, they're good athletes and they're good footballers. That's going to be more challenging for us in the women's space going forward, because if I'm in Melbourne and mum and dad support an AFL team, they're probably going to take me to play AFL first and see if I like that. So, you know, cricket's obviously offering more pathway opportunities. So as a result of that, I think that, yeah, we... And if cost is a barrier as well, perhaps we're not always getting the best athletes. So, but that's a really big issue the whole game has to tackle. And I think that the solution today is not going to be easy, but I feel like we need to start chipping away at that, and understanding, you know, why clubs charge a certain amount and what we can do to support clubs to bring that cost down, and also be more transparent so that parents understand what they're paying for. I mean, it's still amazing that people don't really know where their money's going. That should be something that parents understand, and then they can make a decision based on the service. Am I willing to pay that because the service that I'm going to get at that club, it's great coaching, good environment, good club culture. I'm making that choice. But then for those individuals that can't pay, what are we going to do to support those individuals? And maybe there needs to be more of a national approach to subsidising, you know, kids across the game that we feel need that support, you know, to reach the highest level. So,
coach training fees and stuff? Any movement there?
Yeah, well, we're actually going for a review of the coach education space, the kind of C licence in particular. So I don't know if people are generally aware, but... we are given the permission by AFC to run the advanced courses here, but there's a few restrictions, or there has historically been restrictions. You've got to meet, it's got to be structured in a certain way in order for us to receive that kind of confirmation, which means that when a coach goes through a course, they're not just an FFA course, but they're AFC endorsed as well, which is critical. AFC have started to relax the C licence structure, so they're kind of saying to member associations now, you can figure out what you know, what the best structure for your courses should look like at that level. So as a result of that, Sean Douglas, who's our head of coach education, is looking at that space and working with the TDs across Australia to figure out, how can we make that more accessible? How can we start to bring the cost down and ensure that the content's right as well? But coaching fees is a challenge. Again, I think people assume that all the money comes up to FFA, and that's not necessarily the case. You know, member federations take a fee, FFA takes a fee as well. I personally would love to be in a position where we're not doing that, but at the moment that is subsidising our coach education team. So if we were to reduce those costs, we just have to figure out what the best service model is for the game.
Again, I think, you know, the expectation would be that the FFA would subsidise those, because it's in FFA's best interest long term to have best quality coaches at grassroots.
And I would not disagree with that. However, if we'd have to figure out where that funding comes from the rest of the game. So I think they're the big strategic decisions we need to make around that going forward is, yeah, if we see that as important, you know, it shouldn't be just money in, money out. It should be about an investment. That's the shift that we need to make. And that's not just a shift here. It's a shift all the way down. I mean, I used to work in England, and in England, county associations, basically their main revenue was from coaching courses. So, you know, you take that revenue source away, would they be able to service the football community there in the right way? I'm not so sure. So it's getting the right model right, delivery model, and minimising cost as much as we can. But there's no doubt it's a massive barrier right now. However, I will say, despite that, the numbers of people going through courses has just, you know, gone through the roof in the last few years.
Saw that last picture of the last intake. It was all quite testosterone-ish.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a major challenge for us right now is, I'd say, in the women's game generally, we've made massive progress in lots of areas, but coaching has not really progressed at the same rate. So I think we've got only a couple of people with pro licence. The percentages are under 20, probably, in terms of the other advanced courses. If I look at the W League, for 11 seasons in, I would expect more female coaches in those roles. I go down to the women's NPL. I don't see women's female coaches coming through there either. So as a game, we've got some work to do, and we've got to understand why. And I,
my next question, any ideas on what the reasons are for that?
I think there's some work to do around the football environment. So is it inclusive for women? If you go on a coaching course at the moment and you're the only female, and I have done this, it is quite intimidating. And lots of females will choose not to do that. And also the challenge we've had for females generally is because they haven't necessarily played at a professional level or had that opportunity to play in a professional environment, let's just assume that maybe the previous generation of the Matildas and this one just have been in professional football environments, because that's kind of the evolution of women's football. So those women that were pre that have not also been able to access the men's professional environment. So they haven't been exposed to what good looks like in that space, and had that support. And going on a coaching course alone is just not going to get you there. I mean, if you're coaching a team now, you're a manager, you're a leader, you're not just coaching the players, you've also got a team of support staff around you. So the role of the coach has changed. Females that haven't been in professional bumps have not necessarily been exposed to that. So that lack of opportunity is a major thing. There's also a visibility issue. I mean, that's the picture just shows it. If I'm a female, do I think coaching's for me? I think probably not.
Yeah.
And the thing I struggle with is I talk to players, current and ex-players, and there's a lot of women, not to be too down and out here, but a lot of women have, you know, it's been a struggle just to play the game at the elite level here, and in England as well, that when they get to the end of their time, they're a bit exhausted. So this thought of giving back when they come out of the end of that, probably with certainly knows, you know, not very much in super, they probably haven't got a house, maybe they want to start a family, you know, all of those things, to then start targeting those individuals to go into coaching, which by the way is going to be probably harder than being a player, because there's going to be less of you, and you're going into an environment that maybe isn't inclusive. That's a lot to ask for someone. So I think that there's definitely a bit of work for us to do. And for me, it starts, what we've tried to do though is target females that have got potential. So we've got mentoring programs now, and trying to create more of a network of potential female coaches. Heather Garrick was part of that. Mel Andriata has been part of that. Ray Dower has been part of that. And try and kind of identify and then support those individuals to get to the top of their areas. But visibility is a massive, massive thing, and we don't really have that right now.
Yeah. World Cup bid, though. You've got that underway.
Yeah, well, that's exciting. And I'm very... it would be an absolute game changer if we were to win the rights to host that. And I've said on many occasions, not just for the women's game, but for football generally, it's twice the size of the Asian Cup. I was lucky enough to go to Canada. I was in Jordan. Particularly what FIFA did in Canada was amazing, and the local organising committee there. It's, the largest women's sport competition in the world. The football in the World Cup, I just love Women's World Cup time, because each country now, it's just, the growth is just amazing, and the quality of football. And the countries that before, like Chile come out here, and this is the thing in women's football, because you don't get to see them play much, it's difficult to know how good they actually are. So you can't go by their ranking, because perhaps they haven't played many games. Wow, well, they could play. And they tested us in that first game in particular, and obviously they beat us. So we had to really, you know, step up in the second game in Newcastle. And I think that's just a sign of the way that the women's game is heading now. So, I mean, it's exciting that we would have the opportunity to bring it here. We're up against Japan, so that's, you know, that's tough, because they would put a very good bid forward. We are obviously working hard on government support, which is important for the bid. But from our perspective, it's not just about hosting a really good football tournament. It's actually about what legacy can this leave for the game. And that's something that we're very focused on and trying to thread that in now, rather than wait until closer to, you know, the launch of the tournament to kind of start talking about, you know, what types of initiatives we need to put in place.
Steering clear of Jack Warner types this time. No brown envelopes.
Well, interestingly, I think the Women's World Cup has never been valued that much that anyone would actually politic in that way. So, you know, it's interesting, because someone was saying to me recently, more people are betting on women's football now.
Oh, right.
Okay. And that's actually a sign that people care more in a backhanded kind of way. I'm not saying that's
it's
great.
It's also a sign that they think it's possibly easily corruptible.
Maybe.
Same as the lower leagues of men's football.
Yeah, that's right. But it's happening. So, I think that it's never... The Women's World Cup has always had a different process than the Men's World Cup. So, yes. We're obviously focused on running a good bid, making sure that... And not just thinking about the bid itself, but as we were talking about government before, when we speak to government are keen to women's football in the Matildas is what they want to talk to us about, to be frank, and that's how we get in the door. So, talking to them about the bid, but also then trying to partner with them on other women's football initiatives is what we're trying to do at the moment.
How important do you think it would be to win that bid?
I think it would be a game changer, and I think that people probably don't appreciate what we've won the rights to those. Because it's pretty big, and that tournament would also not, it wouldn't just be good for football, but it'd highlight the commercial value of women's sport, and that's what I took away from Canada. And you saw that the Fox, the US Fox, that they actually, you know, the commercial revenue they actually leveraged from the Women's World Cup in Canada was a game changer. And I think that's a sign that, you know, it's from a value perspective, it's increasing. So I think we'd see more people playing the game. I think it would help us to push the kind of commercial engine generally for women's football. And I think it would help us to start to leverage fans, not just for doubling Matildas, but across the board for football. And I saw that firsthand in Perth. So we hosted Thailand, and the audience that came to the Matildas game was not the audience that goes to Perth Glory. So they're not connecting into Perth Glory, but they connect into the Matildas. We saw it in Penrith, we see it in Newcastle. That just shows you that if we want to have a broader fan footprint, you want to engage with families and you want to engage with girls and boys to some degree as well, because there's a lot of boys in the crowd in those Matildas games. You know, the Matildas does cut through, and it is a connection to different parts of the community that other products in football can't deliver right now. So we should be looking at that kind of holistic way.
Pretty exciting year ahead, really, all right?
Yeah, there's a bit happening. I mean, I'm really... France is going to be amazing. I think that they'll do a really good job.
We've got a World Cup.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
Haven't even talked about that.
No, I know. France next year. And I think, as I said, I was in Canada, and Canada really set this whole kind of explosion of the Matildas off. I remember being there, and actually I was being interviewed by someone on the ABC, and they were telling me that Gil McLachlan that day had announced that they were fast-tracking the Women's League the day after we beat Brazil in Moncton. So I was like, wow, okay, that's the impact that this is having. They're getting a bit scared here. So that was great, but I think, wow, 4 years to now, where the Matildas is now in terms of the... You know, the connection into the community is just, you know, phenomenal. So I'm really excited to see how the football, not just the football, the community reacts back here, you know, while they're in France. And obviously, we need a good draw. So,
when is the draw made?
Next weekend. Saturday, yeah.
How many Matildas fans think you'll follow you out there? Any indications?
We're not really sure yet. I think it will depend. I think once we get the... once we get the draw and we kind of have an idea of locations, I think then that will kind of prompt people to start to think about getting over there. And I think France is a different offering to perhaps Canada, where, you know, it's so accessible to get around that it would be a really good World Cup to get on board with. But
have you picked your base yet?
No, we can't pick. Yeah, we've got to wait to the draw. I mean, the good news of the draw is that we're seeded, so that was very important.
Just about the skin of our teeth.
Literally by like a point. but we'll take that. So the draw is... Being seeded is obviously critical. Last time, I think we were eighth, but we were unseeded. So if you're not seeded, then you basically just... doesn't matter what other... you know, where your ranking is, you just treated the same from then on. Yeah. So, I mean, we ended up with obviously the US and Sweden in our group, which was tough. But, we want to obviously get a good draw. That sets us up for the whole competition.
Get out the draw.
Yeah.
Sky's the limit.
Yeah, there we go. Well, that's it. And then you go into knockout. So, I think that's a really, really important milestone. I'm actually a bit nervous just talking about that right now.
Is there an expectation that, you know, we really should come back with gold?
From my perspective, I think we should be focused on that. Yeah. I think with this group of players, they are good and they can beat anyone. I think that... you know, they've got to be consistent, obviously, throughout the whole tournament. But this group of players is, they're world class. You just look all over the pitch and you see world class players now. So
and on the bench.
Yeah.
So it's got depth throughout the
depth as well.
Every position.
I think we'd be disappointed if we didn't get to semi-final. I mean, it obviously depends on the draw and how the draw unfolds. But, you know, I think that we'd be expecting to at least... do better than we did at the last World Cup.
Yeah.
With all the changes that have happened on and off the pitch since then. So and then you get to semis and then who knows?
World Cup winners.
Yeah, there you go.
There we go. Emma, that's been brilliant. Thank you so much. That was really informative.
No problem. Good to speak to you. It's all over!
What about that? Whoa! One of the strikes of the season. Whoa. Oh, what a goal that is! Penalty! Penalty! Whoa!